My name is John Hartnett. My area of expertise is physics, largely experimental physics in building ultra-stable clocks, but also I've published in astrophysics and cosmology. I'm a biblical creationist. This means I have a biblical worldview, and I have published in many articles in creation journals and published a few books and documentaries and things like that as well. I retired in 2016 from the University of Adelaide, though I spent about 18 years prior to that at the University of Western Australia. I now live in Perth, returning from Adelaide some years ago, and I continue to do research. And, of course, during the COVID era, I've spent a lot of time looking at the science of COVID and all the lies and hypocrisy of that.
This term scientism, I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's
absolutely.
It's the idea that you can turn a science into a religion if you stop being ultra critical of theories. Now, I can remember being taught physics by a particularly excellent Jewish master who told us all, explained to all of us that science actually doesn't know anything. All it is a series of theories. And yet what we're getting here, and I mean, explain that really simply, in that, you know, through history, science has come up with various theories. As history's progressed, those theories generally get overturned and a new hypothesis comes along. But it really is only that. It's only a potential possible explanation. And scientists, there's a certain danger in scientists that get above their station and start to think, well, we actually really do know what's happening once and for all here.
Okay. Well, let me start first with this. A particular professor would start his first year lectures off in physics, telling the students that 80% of what we know in science, in physics, is wrong. Just the trouble is we don't know which 80% is wrong. And now that's a very good characterization of the problem. But look, I would like to define scientism a little differently. I believe it's the belief, and therefore it's this faith position, that science has all the answers. And this has become a modern religion, which is essentially what you're saying. And I would like to separate scientism from the true practice of science, of the scientific method. Now, I think we can define, or we can separate what science is as separate from scientism, which is this that religious aspect to it. And science needs to be separated into two categories. One is operational science, which is what most people confuse with just science in general, this sort of concept of repeatability, which is correct, proposing a hypothesis, testing that against the evidence. And, of course, all you can do is rule out. You can only disprove. Science cannot prove anything. So if you ever see anyone or hear anyone say science has proven this, this is just it's a total misunderstanding of what the scientific method can do. It can only rule out hypotheses. And the other area of science that is much weaker is what we call historical science, which is very much like forensic science, because that attempts to explain events or explain something about what happened in the past. It's very much like a scientist going onto a crime scene where they may take their box of equipment to make samples, blood samples, fingerprints, and so on. Now, that's operational science because that's repeatable. It's carried out in the present. But they then take that evidence and they fit it into a story about what they believe happened in the past. Now, that story is framed within the worldview of that researcher. It's limited by what he already has some idea about what happened in the past. And if you talk about evolution, and when I say evolution, I mean this concept of from goo to you over billions of years, that life evolved in some upward ever-increasing complexity, increasing trend, adding information all the way. Well, that is not operational science. That's historical science at best. That is very weak because you cannot travel into the past and you're limited by the story that you imagine or the worldview of those researchers. And these different types of science are unfortunately conflated and confused in the modern type of thinking. And then I would add that in respect to medical science, that there's even another problem, because obviously in a lab, they do carry out repeatable experiments. But then they say, for example, with a drug test or some of these vaccines, they will then test it on a population group. And that's when things become, unstuck. This is not science in any true sense, because a number of reasons. They use statistical analyses that are very poorly understood systems, and they're dealing with the human body, which is not the same for every person. So I would say that this is not science. And then, of course,
Hang on, John, yeah. Because you just talked about two examples there of kind of imaginative experimentation. What you're saying is, well, we have a hypothesis, say, for example, with evolution. Let's have a look to see if one species could possibly have just evolved into another species, and let's look for the evidence for that. And also with when it comes to the modern medical science with the jabs, you know, you need to have some sort of experiment to see, is it working? So you've got to have a look at, a whole bunch of the population who've had the jab and see how it's affected them. I mean, this is just experimentation. With the other example, it's almost a kind of archaeological evidence gathering.
Well, that's why I call that forensic science, because that is somewhat different to the example in the medical area. But, it's forensic, it's archaeological, and it depends on the researcher's assumptions. Well, I would also add that the medical example, when you're doing statistical analyses on large bodies of people, that also there's a worldview. There's also a belief system that they're fitting that evidence into. And that might be to do with, the idea of science is to, by a null experiment, by refuting, ruling something out. So what are they doing with their vaccine study? They're looking for some statistical significance that it works. That's not how science works. Science is by a null experiment. So if you could then go and rule out all of the negatives, that's how science would work. So if you've got many potential possible mechanisms that could give a certain result and you went and ruled them all out, that's how science would work. But, of course, it's unknown. It's an unquantifiable quantity. And that's the problem with these medicines and drugs and vaccines. They don't know all the inputs. They don't know the conditions of all the people they're putting them into. So they can't rule out. You see what I'm saying? They can't rule by looking for null experiments and the negative results. They can't rule out all the other possibilities of what's causing the reaction or the result. I mean, that's why they do the placebo. Well, they're supposed to. They really do. But that's why they're meant to do a placebo in one arm of the trial, to say to in effect that that placebo arm is not getting the drug, and so they're all
Called it is a control group, isn't it? They have a control group.
That's right. But the placebo effect itself is as powerful as most of the drugs. This is also another known effect. The human mind is really a very powerful agent. And so, but back to the original point, though, of what is science? Science cannot prove anything. So you see, it's already an impossibility right from the outset. And I think probably that's one of the reasons why there is a lot of fraud and a lot of fudging and a lot of leaning on the scales, because they know what they want to get as an outcome. And they definitely try to establish that. And I think there's another aspect to this as well, and that is the issue of the difference, or let's say the comparison between what we call reductionism and emergence. And up until recent times, the way scientific thinking, and including in the medical arena, has gone, they tried to reduce everything down to the smallest element to say that, for example, that some small element is causing the problem or is the cause of the effect that they're observing. But that is also flawed, because that's just an assumption that is an unprovable assumption. And in recent times, particularly the human brain, studies of a neuron development in the human brain, they've discovered the reductionism just doesn't work, and that emergence is this property where 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2, it equals 10, where you have multiple elements, might be neurons, that give you more than the sum of the individuals. And often these emergent properties are not understood. And this now adds another whole dimension to, what we don't know, particularly in how would you say, how the mind works, how the brain works. And this is very significant. But it's also true in many other areas of science and in physics, even so, it's quite significant. Okay, so look, we see many, I would say, there are actually way too many to cover, but there's all the fraudulent side of it, which we don't need to go into, but that has been cropping up over the last few decades. In fact, some years ago, I was reading an article in Nature magazine, which is probably the leading science journal on Earth, and they were documenting how the amount of fraud that does occur in research journals is accelerating. It's almost off the charts. And in the fields of medical science, physiology, and drug development type sciences, fraud is really major. But having said that, what about those that is not fraudulent, where they claim the science was sound? And in the past, we pretty well all of us know about the failures of thalidomide, the morning sickness drug that was given to pregnant women back in the 50s, total failure. But there's other ones that are very, very remarkable. Doctors used to prescribe cigarettes, tobacco to patients for, like nervousness and this sort of thing. And yet that's a failure of science, because the unknowns were not ruled out. It's the same thing with these COVID vaccines. No one's done any long-term studies. Well, it's the same thing back then with smoking. And then also doctors prescribed heroin. That was common. Opium was common. The stimulants like the amphetamines as for weight loss and things like that. And then moving even further back into the 1800s, they prescribed mercury, liquid mercury, as a pretty much a cure-all. And yet, that's one of the most toxic materials on Earth and would send people insane, I mean, causing all sorts of damage. And then in modern times, we've had this massive uptick in the occurrence of autism. Some people have calculated that we're on an exponential trajectory. Like going back, say, 50 years, there's almost no incidence of autism amongst the population. And then we see, as the childhood vaccine schedule has been increased, and I think children now are getting up to something like 70-something shots for about 16 different vaccines, we see now autism accelerating. And one researcher I read about calculates that exponential growth to give us a 1 in 2 autism rate amongst boys by the year 2035. I mean, that is really scary stuff. I had a teacher. He was over my house the other day, and he was talking about his history in teaching here in the high schools. He's been there 40 years, and he said in the early days they had no autistic children in the classrooms. But now at his school, they have as many special ed teachers, that's those who care for the handicapped children, as normal teachers. It's an equal number. So back 40 years ago, there was hardly any need for such teachers. And then moving on to the COVID shots. I mean, this is a massive failure. I mean, this on proportions that is almost, you know, one can't even, it's hard to make oneself even believe it's true. But we're seeing by some calculations, for example, the United States, which has their VAERS, their Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, in tens of thousands being reported as died after the vaccine shots, and yet I think it's an MIT or a Harvard study found that may only be reporting about 1% or a few percent of the actual adverse events. And of course, there's millions of non-death adverse events as well. So it looks like these COVID shots are causing a mass depopulation event. But really, I think the real agenda with them is not, well, maybe you might say it is mass depopulation, but it's definitely some form of surveillance, because we don't know what's in them, and different researchers have using microscopy methods and other scientific methods, particularly a team in Germany, they are discovering pretty wild stuff in them, like self-assembling circuits and things like this that maybe is part of a future surveillance state system. Now, I would say compared to a few decades ago, the failures in the medical science realm were small compared to what's been happening now in the last year and a half. I think this is off the charts.
You've got a lot of potential mistaken bits of science there. But you see, the scientists, if you can call them that, the people who are paid to do this stuff, they would argue, well, science has brought us so much. You know, it's made life so much more convenient. We've got amazing simple transportation systems. We've got telecommunications, which science has brought us, that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. It almost doesn't matter if they've got to get a few things wrong. The fact is that science has made life far more convenient for humanity.
Well, that's a common argument, unfortunately. And I'm a scientist, and I like science. I'm not anti-science by any means whatsoever. But I think the problem is that under this modern era of scientism, we have a new priesthood, And that priesthood nowadays cannot be questioned. And it doesn't, and I'm not just talking about medical science and COVID stuff. I'm talking about pretty well every area. There is an orthodoxy that has developed. And yes, there are benefits. We have had advances, but there's also a lot of control of the narrative about what, like about the failures, for example. I'll give you an example. The whole cancer research scam that's been going on, I don't know, 50 years now, and there's no cure for cancer. But in actual fact, if you're looking at different types of cancer, then the research has found many answers. But that's not convenient. That's not, you know, this is where the politics comes in, because if you say you have a cure for this or that type of cancer, then you lose the ability to get funding from that type of research. And I've heard many stories of different people who have been shut down when they were on very, very promising lines of research because, you know, they don't want to stop the gravy train. In fact, I read on a sort of a joke, I suppose, it is a joke, on one of these medical scientists' office when I was at University of Adelaide, and he said that curing cancer, or the promise to cure cancer, is how we get our grant funding, but not curing cancer is how we get our salaries. So it's, you know, it's just a money train, a gravy train. And when the Australian government started talking about mitigating climate change and research to stop man-made global warming at the university when I was there, pretty well everyone was trying to think of different angles in their research that they could bring global warming or climate change, as they call it, into that in order to get research funding. So you see, humans will use anything, even if their research has got nothing to do with it, they will try to manipulate the numbers and manipulate the narrative in order to get what they want. And this is part of the problem. Humans are intrinsically flawed. They're not as altruistic or as, you know, how would you say, self-sacrificing as you might hope for. And so you have flawed people running a flawed system. And
yeah, I mean, the system, it's surely the system that's the major problem here, because what it's saying is if you want funding to continue, you know, in order to further your career, number one, also to simply to feed your family, then you've got to twist whatever it is you're researching or whatever it is you're thinking to fit to this certain agenda. So, you know, for example, you might be, doing an experiment on increasing the yield of runner beans, for example, and on allotments, and then say, well, you don't have any success in getting any funding to do that. But if you say, well, actually, we're looking at the growth of runner beans as it relates to the changing climate, then you suddenly find your funding is arriving.
Absolutely. You're hitting it on the head. Exactly. So people will manipulate that narrative, even telling outright lies. Because, you know, I mean, everyone's busy. Reviewers who read research grants, they're probably reading like dozens of them, and they have fatigue. They're doing it late at night because that's not their job. You know, they have a normal career. And so, yeah, it's a sort of a system where everyone fits into. And, you know, you hobnob with various people, you meet them at conferences and you become friends with them, and that's the main reason you get your funding. You tell the right story and get to know these people. Of course, you don't know who does the reviewing, but you just meet everyone in your field and, you know, trying to be a nice guy, and that's how you get on. You know, you learn to get on that way. Yeah, I don't have an answer for a better system, But the system itself right now, I believe, is very broke.
Well, okay. I would suggest, and I do have an answer, I think, for a better system, and that is that, you know, we need to – there's this thing called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 25, written after the Second World War, talks about people having the right to housing, the right to food, the right to employment, the right to water, all these sort of basic, you know, needs to live. And what's been slowly happening is that, you know, we have had those things slowly withdrawn, so that we need to have an income to get water. You know, it's funny because people who rented property here in the UK never paid for water. It was always something that the landlord would pay for. Now, of course, the opposite thing is so that you have to pay for every drop of water as you turn the tap on. That's so what they're doing is they're saying all those basic essentials of life have to be paid for. I think, you know, what we need to do is we need to have a system whereby people are guaranteed a roof over their head, they're guaranteed water to drink, this sort of thing, and then they can then they can walk away from a situation where somebody's trying to coerce them into. At the moment, you know, they're being coerced into playing this game that you're talking about. But look, maybe getting into talking about creation science a bit more. One of the frauds which I find particularly irritating is the Piltdown Man. I mean, I think this is between the wars, or around about the time of the First World War. A skull was so-called discovered, and science was raging about it. It was supposed to be the missing link between ape and man. And of course, this did a big boost for Darwin's theory of evolution at the time, which was being hotly contested. And yet, ultimately, and I think it was probably around about in the 1930s or 40s, this was discovered to be complete nonsense and a fraud. Yeah. So the evidence, where the evidence doesn't exist, some people are prepared to, to actually just simply fabricate it and con millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, there's many examples of that sort of stuff, particularly in the various – well, this is, again, the historical science side of things, archaeology, paleontology, making up stories. There's – I think it's Arthur Pithecus Ramidus, I think it is. It's one where they found just a few knuckle bones. And maybe there might have been even a part of a skull, but they were found over 4 kilometers apart, and yet they would put that together. So this is part of that storytelling. There are many cases. Now you might say, well, that's not fraud. Yeah, but it's really good imagination. I mean, there may be no relationship. The very famous story of the Brontosaurus that we saw, like in the Flintstones comics, cartoons, it came a point where they claimed that they had put the wrong head on the wrong body of this, you know, the fossil skeletons, and therefore the Brontosaurus never existed, and it was really one of these other ones. But then 10 or 15 years later, they found a complete skeleton, and they said, oh, no, we were right, the Brontosaurus does exist. So you see, this is all just storytelling, and the stories constantly change. Each of the paleontologists that discovers what he believes to be a new species will get to name it, and usually have his name in that Latin designation. But often these ancient dinosaurs are just different sizes. They're probably a lot of them of the same species, and yet because they're found in different states of growth when they died, they get new labels. So it's all very, very flexible. And,
okay, well, look, I mean, we're getting into talking about creation now and creation science specifically. Could you start by, telling us about this whole sort of thing about the dinosaurs and, you know, what you think's happened there? It doesn't really talk about dinosaurs in the Bible, and there's no part of that. So maybe you could just explain how dinosaurs all fit into all of this so-called creation science, John.
Okay, I will. just before I answer that, I would like to give a little bit of introduction to this on what we would call epistemology, you know, the origin of knowledge, or how do we know what we know? And it's very important to understand that whatever, and this is where this is part of the weakness of historical science, all studies require some initial assumptions, axioms, but they're unprovable initial assumptions. And you build your hypothesis on those initial starting assumptions. So now back to the dinosaurs. So finding a dinosaur fossils in of itself doesn't actually tell you anything about its history, when it lived or whatever. It's got to be fitted into a storyline. And that fitting into the storyline, or the storyline itself, is what the researcher has in his mind. It's his worldview. So all of the evidence you find in the present is interpreted within that worldview. Now, I would say that, in fact, I can say this for a fact, that my initial assumptions are based on the biblical account. Now, I say that because God, the creator of the universe, is the self-existent one. That's what he calls himself, Yahweh, in the Bible. And he created the universe only about 6,000 years ago. He created everything. He created all life. Now, that's my starting assumption. And evolution has may have completely different starting assumption. If he's an atheist, he may believe there was a Big Bang, and then you have evolution over billions of years. I mean, cosmic evolution. I'm talking about formation of stars and galaxies, and eventually some event on Earth about 4 billion years ago. You have chemicals randomly coming together and forming life. Now, and then that life evolved over 3.8 billion years to what we have today.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you again, John. John, yep. Sorry to interrupt you again, but, you know, this is, yep. I think it's worth pointing out that this idea of it all being completely proven, the Big Bang, and that it's hundreds of millions of years since life first started here on Earth, this is something which, certainly in my lifetime, has gone from something which was gently contested, you know, and to something which is now supposedly a proven fact.
Yeah, well, this is back to what I said earlier. Science cannot prove anything. You only can disprove hypotheses. You cannot prove hypotheses. And so really what's happened in your lifetime, the story has been expanded and the narrative around that story has been sort of reinforced. They find some new evidence and they say, that fits in here. But if they find some fossils, fossiliferous material or something, and they fire in layers of sedimentary rocks, which is where it needs to be found, because they're saying it's that they're laid down by water, which a creationist would not dispute, because we believe nearly all fossils are the result of animals and plants that died in the flood, in Noah's flood, 4,500 years ago. But now, say they find a fossil in a certain sedimentary layer. Now, part of the story of fitting that into that timeline, that evolutionary timeline of billions of years, is to identify how old it is. And the way that is done in with the evolutionary worldview is you take sediments above and below where you find the fossil, because, you know, they are... I think we talked about carbon dating before. Well, they normally wouldn't even use carbon dating because they don't believe there could be any carbon 14 left, because the fossils are meant to be millions or tens of millions of years old. So they will look at radioactive elements, decay processes, uranium decay to argon or rubidium, strontium, and so on, different decay processes. And they will look at those half-lives. They'll look at how much mineral daughter and parent products are there and so on. And they still have to make unprovable assumptions about the starting condition of those minerals. And then they may come up with a number. Say they come up with a number of 100 million years from one decay process. But if they look at, say, and often they do this, look at multiple different decay processes, and say they come up with contradictory numbers, say, from a different decay process, well, they'll choose the one that fits closely or fits the best into the narrative, into the timeline. So you see, this is totally flexible. There's no, it's not the operational science where you don't measure how old something is. In fact, there is no technique whatsoever where you can absolutely determine the age of anything, regardless of what it is. As a creationist, I take the timeline of the Bible as my reference, but I don't argue that that's scientific. I know that that's a faith position. That's a worldview that I know that I take that as my starting assumption, because I know you can't prove how old anything is. You know, we can only measure things in the present, and there's a whole pile of assumptions that go into even any of these dating schemes.
What about just general evidence for creation? If we're just looking at, you know, looking out there, where is it?
There's enormous amount of evidence. In fact, I would say we are inundated with the evidence. So if we put on our biblical glasses, so in other words, we're now willing to look at the evidence within a biblical worldview, a biblical framework, we are inundated with it. Because possibly the most it's hard to rank the information like this, but living systems, the molecular machinery in the human or any cells, any organisms, that organizational complexity is absolutely incredible. And There's a very important point to this that physicists know very well, and that is thermodynamics. We know that there's the second law tells us that random, you know, in the presence of heat, which all living things are, there's random processes going on. There's vibration, and because all molecules are vibrating, they have energy, and DNA is a particularly very fragile molecule. When it unfolds in order to make a copy, which it has to do, all the cells have to constantly are copying their DNA and replicating, sometimes it makes an error and you get what we call a mutation. And most of those errors are what we call slightly deleterious. They're so slight variation, they don't cause the organism any major problem. So in the offspring, no major problem. But the problem is they accumulate. There is no natural selection process that can filter them out because it doesn't cause the organism a major problem, and therefore they accumulate over time. And you can look at different animals, different organisms, even humans, and we see over generations, we see a genetic burden, a genetic load accumulating in all our DNA. And so slowly we get this increase in mutational damage that does cause significant genetic damage and mutations. And the trouble is you can look at that as a process that there's a limit to how much mutation the organism can stand before you have a genetic meltdown. And this is well known in Australia because of the problem with the Tasmanian devils. They are very small inbreeding population group, and they have been passing these mutations amongst themselves to the point now that they have a very serious type of facial tumours, and And it's very possible that they will go extinct, particularly on the island of Tasmania anyway, because of this type of genetic load that's rapidly accumulating.
Okay, so what's happening with these? I mean, surely by now all species would have gone in the same route from what you're saying, John.
No, but all species, it is decaying, but they at different rates. It depends on the complexity. It depends on the diversity of the animals within that group.
I'm sure that evolutionists would say, if that sort of genetic damage does start to develop, then it will die out. And that's the theory of evolution for you.
Yeah, but the trouble is with evolution, they need upward mutations. And this is really a good point that you bring this up. They need positive mutations that add information. And in the presence of rapid decay of the organism, even if you have a few small positive mutations, which, by the way, we don't observe, they've never, ever been observed, but even if we had a few, even if we allowed for that, the organism would still accumulate this massive load of defective genes. And I think a very good analogy for it is like your car. Say you have your car sitting in the driveway, and it just sits there for years and years and years. Well, it's rusting. All different parts of it are starting to rust. And then one day you go out there and it doesn't turn over. You need a new battery. So you go buy a new battery and it does start. And you say, oh, fix my car. But you haven't, because the whole thing is rusting away. So even if you repair something, which, by the way, takes intelligent design to do that, it's not a random process that suddenly created a new battery. Now, I know this is an analogy, so you can't push it too far, but it's exactly the same principle. And depending on how much genetic diversity there is within the populations, it depends on the rate of it's called genetic drift, and depends on how fast that drift occurs. But look, the organizational complexity of living systems is inexplicable. Now, I know they hand wave and they say, isn't it amazing that evolution did this and natural selection did this? But as I said, no observed positive mutations have ever been observed. There's a few debatable issues, but it's always a loss of information. For example, sickle cell anemia, which is where the blood cells turn into like little sickle shapes. Well, people who get that genetic mutation and causes that, they have an immunity to malaria, because the malaria parasite cannot make a home in those blood cells. But that's not an increase of information. It's actually a loss of information that caused it. And the rest of the person is weakened and sickened. So they can only survive in a very specialized, isolated habitat. Maybe they need pharma drugs for the rest of their life too, because of all the other problems, the bloodborne problems that they have. But you see, you don't get Superman randomly evolving out of pond scum. It just never happened. It never did happen. And we don't observe any such thing happening today. I will say, though, I'm not talking about natural selection. Natural selection works, but it only eliminates, it's a downward trend. It eliminates the organisms that are weak and can't survive within their particular habitat. It's always a downward trend, though, you know.
One of the most mind-blowing things is the Pink Floyd. You remember them? The rock band and their album, yeah. The Dark Side of the Moon, which has got an eclipse on the cover. And I think, in a way, they're sending quite an interesting message to the world with that. Back in the late 1970s they released it, because the eclipse is quite an incredible thing, isn't it? It's hardwired into our universe. We've got a sun which is roughly 93 million miles away, a moon which is about a quarter of a million, isn't it, I think, miles away.
Yet
you look up in the sky and these two disks, of course the ancients must have been kind of awe-inspired by all this, are almost exactly the same size, even though we now know that one is something like 400 times further away. This is an interesting coincidence, isn't it? You know, because there are only two big heavenly bodies out there, and that's a pretty amazing coincidence. So when those, you know, getting back to Pink Floyd, when those two come into an eclipse, the moon and the sun, you know, that you can see for yourself that they're both the same size. In fact, they're so similar in size that sometimes the sun has a little halo around the moon, and sometimes the moon just about completely obscures it when it goes past, if you're standing obviously in the right side of the world and you know in the right place to see it. But that to me is a very powerful and important symbol of, as you say, intelligent design. There's also the amazing miracle of water, which is this idea of water actually freezing from the surface down rather than the bottom up, which is not the way most substances operate, which of course ensures that when it gets cold, there's a pretty good chance that all the little creatures living in the water underneath it will keep going, and they may slow down a bit. I imagine they probably stop completely when it gets really cold, but it means that they don't die. So there's something quite incredible going on. Obviously, water is the most important substance on the planet in many ways, there's loads of it around. So what with the when you look down at the water and when you look up at the sun and the moon, there are some very important, powerful symbols there. There is intelligent design here, and yet people don't seem to notice these things these days, John.
Well, that's right. On the moon, is really quite amazing. I mean, what you said about matching the disk of the moon are matching the sun. If you're in the right spot, of course, you can see a perfect match. And this actually allowed astronomers to calculate the distance of the sun because of trigonometry. But, I mean, the design features of the moon are quite remarkable. It has a near perfectly circular orbit. By random processes, you can't get a circular orbit of a satellite. It always tends to be elliptical. But the circular orbit of the moon is a stabilizing effect on planet Earth. It has a number of different features, and one of them is even the tides. The tides are, you know, forcing the tides into the bays and the inlets and so on to wash out the crap and everything that accumulates in there. And that's a very important design feature for life on Earth. There are many properties here. The water itself, the very fact that it freezes when it gets down to 4 degrees centigrade, and expands and therefore is lighter than the liquid, allowing fish life and so on to live under the ice. But then the fish themselves have a form of antifreeze in their system that stops them freezing. And so, like, you got fish living in the Antarctic oceans at minus 70 degrees centigrade, and they're not even slowed down. I mean, this is sort of the design features that we're seeing in these type of systems. I mean, they're everywhere. Life is everywhere on Earth, and even at the deepest trenches, many kilometers down, you have life. Even where there's no sunlight, there's different forms of life that can metabolize from other processes, not using sunlight, but using hydrogen sulfide and things like that, to derive energy.
Hey, you're talking about politicians now, are you?
Well, it might as well as be, you know. But I think people don't appreciate life as much as they once did when they had respect for the fact that we are created in the image of God. And nowadays, with the concept of we just evolve, we're nothing more than animals, that type of respect and admiration for the creation is largely gone from our societies. And it's become this sort of reductionist world, you know, that you go to the doctor and he gives you a pill and he can fix you. Well, actually, none of that's true. Humans and all life are very complex systems, that it's just the height of hubris to believe that we even understand how these things work, and that it's all been sort of reduced down to these bare elements of this molecule or that molecule, but the complexity of the systems is just mind-boggling. You know, one good example of that is in the early days of DNA research, like DNA discovery. They found that a very large chunk of the DNA molecule didn't seem to code for any proteins. They called them junk DNA, as if it's like 80% of it appeared that it had no function. And but nowadays it's been discovered that it all has function. There's no such thing as junk DNA. The DNA folds in very complex ways that these different introns, introns and introns are like start and stop signals, and they all have a type of function, just maybe a lot of it's not even discovered yet. So that's why I say the height of hubris to believe that we've just sort of sorted it all out and we become like the creator himself, which Yuval Noah Harari has claimed that that they have become as gods, which is quite interesting. We were talking about him last time, and it's interesting that his name, Yuval, comes from the Hebrew word Yuval, which we translate or transliterate as Jubilee in English, which means reset. And Noah, which is the name of Noah who built the ark at the time when God imposed possibly the first great reset on earth, that his name also means essentially reset. And so I think it's a little bit of irony here that the guy who claims that man now has become divine and can hack the humans and essentially all living organisms, really they don't know anything. I think this is possibly an even bigger joke from God, that God is bringing his great reset and their great reset will be totally and utterly thwarted.
Yes, I mean, Catherine Austin Fitz, I think, is quite well known in the States particularly. She has said, John, she's quite famously said, there's a war on God and God's going to win. I mean, you could certainly look at much of the last couple of hundred years, as, and particularly since World War II, where we had at the beginning of the Second World War, we had Winston Churchill declaring that, that this was a war on Christian civilization that Adolf Hitler was waging, and that Christendom was fighting back. And, now since then, it seems almost that Christendom has now been forgotten about, and the idea that that there is a God has been eradicated. And in a way, that Nazi victory has been slowly but surely pursued ever since World War II.
Yeah, I would say it's been accelerated. That it's, the Nazis didn't really go away. It's now the Fourth Reich or whatever it is, and they are accelerating their process, with eugenics and the abortions and the culling. I think a lot of these COVID shots are sort of like a human-directed evolution. They want to see who survives, sort of like maybe the strongest will survive, the survival of the fittest. And this is the demented mindset of these megalomaniacs, narcissists, or what is it, sociopath, they have no feelings. But I think that's right. I think it is an attack on Christianity. It's an attack on God. And they are upping the ante. But from the book of Revelation, I know God wins. You know, they go down. They go down seriously badly. And ultimately, the scripture says that these evil ones who follow Satan, Lucifer, the devil, they are cast into the lake of fire. I mean, God brings them before. We don't judge them. God judges them. He opens the books. And if their name's not found in the book of life, they are thrown into then the lake of fire, which the Hebrews called Gehenna. It was like the place outside the city, which was where they burnt the garbage. And they would say that fire was always burning because always throwing garbage there. And so that's the imagery for hell, the place of eternal burning.
Well, it'd be fascinating to know what you think, how you think they think. In other words, you know, this sort of Fourth Reich Nazi mentality. What's the mindset of these elitist psychopaths that think they're gods?
I believe what it is that because they are atheists, well, I would say mesotheists, which is God hater. So deep down they're God haters, but they believe there is no God and there's no life after this life. And therefore, their purpose right now is a mad rush to develop technology, you know, like you're like the Borg or like some sort of transhumanist robot type technology that they can live on indefinitely. To, you know, like there's been movies like this, like The Ghost in the Machine, or the, you know, there was a very good one from South Africa where they uploaded someone's consciousness into this mechanical robot. I think that's the sort of imagery. I don't know if you ever saw that movie called Millennium Man. It was Robin Williams was the main star, and he was sort of uploaded, or I'm not sure if he started out as a robot, but over time he got upgrades on his body, and he essentially was living for thousands and thousands of years. And moving towards the end of the movie is where he doesn't even need a body. He's sort of got to a point where he's become ascendant, as they say. He's become God, some sort of thing like this. And I think that is their belief system. That's their religious view. Of course, this is mass and gross deception coming from Lucifer, who's, you know, is the master of deception, the master of lies, and they have fallen in with him, and that's the reason they're pushing this, because they need to do this very quickly now. As you'll notice, a lot of them are pretty old, the ones that we do know of, and I think even some of the ones we don't know much about are even more ancient than those we know.
I mean, surely, John, I mean, they must know that into their DNA when they were born is hardwired their death. So, you know, they're even talking now, the transhumanists, about being able to genetically engineer the human genome to make it so that people do not die. They just carry on forever and try and change various bits of DNA to wire out this whole idea of death.
Yeah, well, this is a total ignorance of the science that we do know, the operational repeatable science, and that is genetic entropy that I mentioned earlier, that there is no way to stop entropy. I mean, everything decays, the genomes decay. So the point is, even if you found some, turned off some genetic switch, you know, like programmed a cell death type switch, you turn that off, but then all the other features of that coding, you know, the human genes, they're still all decaying. And so you know, it's like they start to manifest all types of different genetic diseases. Even if you're up at 150 or something, there's like nothing left. You know, the whole body system is continually breaking down because of this genetic entropy problem. And there's no getting around it. The Bible says, "For it's given unto man once to die, and after that the judgment." I mean, that's final. That's what's coming. I mean, it's coming for all of us, but most of us are not under this type of delusion.
What about the techniques which are used then, do you think, to convince people that there is no life after death, there is no God? What would be your main, you know, holes you'd poke in that if you were to see someone who said, well, of course, you know, there is no such thing as life after death, that's just a fairy story?
Well, I think you have to go back to those evidences and this issue of worldview. You have to go back to that, because to say to someone, like to say, you know, like to prove the existence of God to someone, now that's completely a flawed statement. You know, you can't prove the existence of God. You can't prove anything, because as this whole issue to do with the nature of science. But you have to take people back to a faith position, that where did we come from? And so you can then argue about evidence. And I think one of the most powerful pieces of evidence to start with a lot of people is the origin of life itself. Now, if they believe in an evolutionary worldview, you have to challenge them on the origin of life, because if life can't spontaneously arrive from inanimate molecules, then the whole rest of that structure collapses completely and utterly. It's gone. And I remember some years ago, I've been to Japan. I worked there in research labs. And there was one time one of these leading scientists who worked on this origin of life. His name eludes me at the moment, but he was a guy that had developed one of their best mechanisms they believe in, which is to do with the RNA as a template, a template molecule. Like there was an RNA world before there was DNA, and he's giving this lecture to a group of Japanese researchers, about 300 of them. I came in a little bit late. And I, as always, a seat at the front row. So I sat on the front row. And when he had finished speaking, it went to question time. And so I asked him. I said, "Now, you know, very respectfully, you've been working in this field for a very long time, and you've got your own hypothesis on how life arose, and." You know, I shouldn't say hypothesis, that's probably too strong a word. It was his speculation, maybe. But I asked him to give me a solid line of evidence that life arose from non-living molecules. I asked him to give me one solid line of evidence. And he said to me, after thinking for about 10 minutes, he said, "I can't. I don't know of any." And yet this is the guy who's one of the world leaders in this field. And the fact of the matter is, even in journals like a Journal of Evolutionary Biology and things like that, you will rarely ever find a paper on the origin of life. Now, I mean, you understand what I'm saying, life from non-life, because no one has a clue on how that can occur, because it defies everything we know about physics and chemistry, biology, because living systems are they live very high up on the energy scales. If you don't have the internal machinery of the living organism, it will decay down into the lowest energy state, which is just random molecules. That's called death and decay. Mm. And well, I need that.
I like your use of this concept of entropy. I think it's very important. You know, as we, this is something else we experience out there in the world. You know, you leave a something out in the rain, it gets, as you were talking about earlier, a bit of rust or whatever. These things degenerate. Yeah. They go from a higher energy state to a lesser energy state. It was what you were saying earlier about Newton and thermodynamics. Entropy is what we observe around us. Actually, life is in complete. The opposite direction. It's doing something totally different. And I think one of the most interesting, certainly one of the most interesting studies I've come across, I say a study, it's actually a very entertaining book, is by James Perloff, called Tornado in a Junkyard, where he's saying effectively, look, life coming out of nothing is like a tornado going through a junkyard and causing a great disruption and throwing up a fully functioning 747, you know, jet.
Yeah. That quote actually is from Fred Hoyle. It's actually a quote from Fred Hoyle.
Yeah.
Fred Hoyle was not an evolutionist, but he wasn't a believer either. He believed in panspermia, that life came from outer space.
Tell us a bit more about Fred Hoyle then.
Yeah, Fred Hoyle was, he's one of your countrymen. He was a very famous he's dead now, but he was knighted, so he was very well respected in his community. He was in the early days there were competing cosmologies developing through the, probably 40s and 50s and then into the 60s. Fred Hoyle and a few others were proponents of the steady state theory. Their idea was that the universe never had an origin, never had a moment in time where it came to be. It was always existed. And so that was a way they were trying to get around this problem, and entropy is a problem there as well. And so they developed this idea that the universe continually creates new stars to fill in where stars have died or decayed, or if they allow expansion, so that it expands and then the vacuum gets filled in by the creation of new stars. Well, that was competing with the newly developed Big Bang theory that really started with Lemaître in the late 1920s. The idea there was that Lemaître's idea was that the universe began in this primeval egg and exploded and out. So it was at a moment in time, because he was a Catholic lecturer and a believer in some sense in God. But these two models competed quite strongly during the war. After the war, particularly, there was a big competition between the two different camps. And Fred Hoyle called the Big Bang believers evangelists. He essentially likened them to the sort of Christian type view, because they had this origin in time, like a creation story, even though most of them were atheists anyway. But that he famously quipped about these type of things. He made many famous sort of wry humor type jokes along that line. I was going to say, as part of his steady state theory, he had also to solve the problem of life. And that's where panspermia, meaning life, from out there, blew in on the wind. And he wrote also fiction novels. And I think one of them was called Andromeda something or other. And it was the idea life blew in from the stars in some sort of science fiction story. Well, you know, he wrote fiction as well as non-fiction, but I think even a lot of his non-fiction was really fiction, because really cosmology and, what we would call it, astrobiology, it's storytelling also. It's not science. It's not testable. It's not. It's just again a religious. It's a belief system, and but he. I mean, he was. Hoyle was very respected in a lot of other ways because in astrophysics he had made a lot of advances and developments that were not related to origins issues. So he sort of dabbled in various areas, but he was definitely an atheist who projected out that life came from outer space. Well, you can see the problem with that. You know, you say it blew in on some meteor or comet or something. The question then is, where did it come from? So you just, all you're doing is this regression problem, pushing back. You know, or if you say an alien race created, the next question you have to ask, well, who created them?
Well, yeah, it's almost like doing a geographical. You're saying, well, don't look, you look over there, but oh, I'm sorry, that's a star that's so far away is we can't really see what's going on. You know, it's just getting rid of the problem. Right. But look, one of the key things about all of this has got to be, you know, if the Big Bang Theory is correct, one must be able to look up at the universe now and track it back. So we would need to know, wouldn't we, that the universe is expanding, and if it is expanding, that it's feasible to track it back to a single point of origin?
That's right. So that would be the concept. There's a few points in this. Number one, you would have to have strong evidence of expansion. I've looked at all the evidence, pro and against expansion, and I find it's equivocal, that there is as much evidence against expansion as there is for it. And so you can't say either way. I would say, based on a biblical worldview, there's no evidence for an expanding universe. Now, I know a number of people claim various verses where it says God spread out the heavens or the stars, the host of heaven, and so on. But if you look at the Hebrew words and the context, it's like putting up a tent or putting up a curtain. There is no implication of like the expanding, like rubber balloon kind of analogy of massive expansion, which means thousands and thousands of times linear expansion. It doesn't exist in the Bible. So if you look at the evidence, either way, it's not clear. But the most powerful line of evidence that they should find, if you have a expanding universe from, you know, out of a primordial singularity, is if you look back in time, accordingly looking back in space, then as you get further and further away, you should see more, or how would you say, let's say baby galaxies or less formed galaxies, you should see them in more earlier phases of development, smaller in size, and then you should eventually get to a point where you see almost no galaxies at all. But that's not the evidence. We astronomers are able to look back now to what they claim is to within 400 million years of the Big Bang. This is getting back to redshifts of about 12. And at these type of levels, distance scale, so this is redshift scale, which according to them translates as a distance scale because of their belief in the expansion of the universe, these galaxies should be, as I'm said, they should be more juvenile, if we can use that word, but they're not. We find large, complex galaxies that are very much similar to the galaxies we see nearer to us. So we don't see that line of evidence. And another line of evidence that should be, they talk about what are called population 3 stars. So they say in the early phase of star formation, the stars were mostly made out of just hydrogen and helium, very little of the heavier metals like iron and nickel and carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. They're all called metals in astronomy. It's kind of weird stuff. But anyway, you shouldn't find them in those stars as you get back. And so they should discover these like pristine stars called population 3 stars, but we don't. And that's another problem, you see. So all of these lines of evidence, star formation itself is a complete problem, total problem. No one knows how stars can form, not based on the known laws of physics. And so they have to make up something. They have to create their own god. And their god in this case is dark matter. Dark matter has exactly the properties they need to overcome known physics so stars can form and hence galaxies can form and clusters and so on. But dark matter is not observed. It's by definition dark and it can't be seen. And so it's essentially creating their own gods in order to fit the storyline. They create the god that they need. And this, you know, this is like any other ancient groups who just forge their own gods out of a bit of metal or wood or something and then started worshipping them. Well, it's pretty much the same.
Joe, I mean, surely this sort of thing can't stand up to being peer-reviewed.
Well, of course it does. Absolutely. The whole dark matter paradigm is constantly being published, peer-reviewed and published. It's because all those who review those papers are believers. They're followers of that cult. I mean, the limit of where dark matter, it's not just limited to dark matter. I should say dark entities where that has come to. Now they propose dark radiation, some type of sterile neutrino. That means a neutrino that has no charge and doesn't interact with any other matter. And then they've come to the point where they believe you could have dark galaxies. They're totally made out of dark matter. And some people even suggest dark life that evolved on dark planets in dark galaxies. I mean, it's ludicrous stuff, the limits that they
were. Well, I mean, it's funny because last week on our show, we were looking at this thing called the Dark Enlightenment. So, which is, a kind of, it's a sort of post-truth kind of science where anything can be true if we say it's true.
Well, that's exactly what's happened in modern astronomy and cosmology. The dark paradigm has taken it over. I remember one time asking a guy who was a leading professor at UWA in the in this particular astrophysics center. He was giving a lecture talking about the formation of the filamentary structure of the universe. I mean, we're talking about each point is a galaxy, so it's massive scale formation, and they tend to form into these long filament structures. And he talked all through that lecture about the role of dark matter in forming it. And after the lecture, just privately, I asked him, I said, don't you think, though, that you're giving the dark matter the, which is, remember, this is totally unseen, undetected. No one's ever detected it. You're giving it the properties of the physics properties that you want in order that you're modeling. And, of course, they use supercomputer modeling to model large chunks of the universe to try and get them to form into what they observe. And I said, you're just giving it the properties that you need. And what if it's not that? I even suggested it might be unknown physics. And he said, yeah, that is totally possible. So it's, you know, this back to this question of the hubris to believe that they understand this. And I remember a Nobel laureate one time, this is years back now, he was giving a lecture at ANU. I was at a conference there, Australian National University, and this Nobel laureate was giving a lecture to a group of about 500 high school students trying to encourage them to get into science. And in the end, toward the end of his lecture, he was talking on astrophysics, cosmology, and he said toward the end, he said, "We know nearly everything about the universe except what is dark energy and what is dark matter, which comprise 96% of the universe." I mean, that was all in one sentence he said to them, and I don't think he realized how ludicrous that must sound to those students, you know. It's like saying we don't know hardly anything about the universe, and these ideas of dark energy and dark matter are just made up fudge factors. That's all they are, in order to get it to fit the paradigm, fit the narrative that they want.
Okay, well, look, I mean, so given that we've got some sort of intelligent design, the evidence for that, how do you draw that out and separate that out from a biblical worldview? Because there'd be quite a lot of people who would recognize intelligent design, but just not necessarily, connect that to the Bible.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's not science. That comes down to your worldview. And that's really an important issue. What are your starting assumptions? Because, yeah, you can look at the evidence and you can say the evidence is consistent with or supports the hypothesis of intelligent design. And the next question then is, how do you identify who that creator or designer is? You can't get that from any observation. It's not possible, because it's the problem of the universe is it's overdetermined, meaning that how would you explain this? There are more possibilities explain cause than you can imagine. You know, say you might try and go through lots of different possibilities to explain cause or explain that design, but what if you're forgetting one? And that's the problem. So personally, I go to the source. I go to an eyewitness who was there, who was the creator of the universe, and he wrote us the Bible. He wrote us a text. And I've been criticized for taking that position, but I don't believe there is any other position to identify the creator, because he is the self-existent one. I mean, it's pretty hard to get your mind around that concept, that a creator God has always existed and creates space and time and everything in the universe. I mean, that's what Genesis 1:1 says, right? In the beginning, God created, and it says heaven and earth. Well, that's a Hebrew idiom or sentence structure, which means they add two parts together to form a whole. So created heaven and earth means created the whole universe. And that's a statement that God has given us. I believe that was passed on down through Adam, the first man, and it's been preserved to us in the texts, so that we do have a source. I mean, faith comes through the Word of God, through believing what God says, reading what God says and believing it. And then from there we can build, like the scaffold, we can build on that underlying belief system or those
axioms. I think it's also, I mean, but for many people also do have a what they would probably call a relationship with God, which it comes through, yeah, maybe through their conscience, you know, where God is sort of prickling them, or they feel that there's a sort of spiritual aspect to things where they have an innate sense of morality or right or wrong. People also have what are called religious experiences, so it will be something that where they feel in some way in a kind of very personal spiritual touch with the creator. But what about this concept of the first cell? I find this a really good challenge. I think, every young scientist, sort of A-level student or whatever, 18, 19 years old, should be looking at this, which is maybe even younger than that. Why not? The idea of the first cell, because this is quite a problem, isn't it, for the evolutionists? The idea that the first cell, which is an incredible incredibly complex little organism that ever created that functioned. That's also, right. At the same time, managed to not only did it start, but it also managed to miraculously have the ability to reproduce itself. Which, you know, to me, that's the point at which we start to look at it scientifically and say, well, that's just not possible. If a cell manages just to somehow randomly occur, how can it also be able to reproduce? So, what do you make of that argument?
Absolutely true. There's two parts to that. The first part I've already addressed. This is the actual process of the chemical system that brings about life itself that you find in those cells, right? But then that first cell, you can't say it like that because there's no way that chemistry can form, because we're talking about coded information coded onto a DNA. There's no way that information can come from nothing, from random molecules. It's just not possible. But then the problem is, even if you said, okay, somehow or other it did happen, which I'm not believing it's possible, even if it did, then what's the use of it? You need a whole system of cells. You need a population. It's like talking about organism. You need a population of those organisms. Otherwise, they can't pass on their genetic information. You know, one organism alone is insufficient. You need a whole population. And it's, again, this problem of genetic entropy. So even if one cell, by some miracle, and that's what it would have to be, formed and then was just left on its own, then the genetic decay would be so staggering that it could not survive. So you need to have a diverse system in order to pass on genes, and that's part of that problem. But I think you have to go back to the origin of life first. Because without origin of life, there is no Darwinian evolutionary process. That's why I say goo to you, because from the pond scum, you have to build over time all that complexity. And at every step, you have to have added information. And it's a law. It's as law as powerful as the law of gravity, that information does not arise by random chance. I mean, it was common back in the days of Louis Pasteur to say that a rotting meat left on its own doesn't produce flies, you know, because prior to that they believe life came just out of the rotting meat. But abiogenesis, the life from non-life, it's been a law of chemistry and biology for a very long time, and somewhere along the line in the evolutionary class they then change the labeling and say abiogenesis happens, it takes a very long time to happen. This is just, again, it's sleight of hand, it's disingenuous, because it just doesn't happen. Never observed in a lab ever. Yeah. So that's what I'd say to them.
Also, there is this basic concept, which isn't really necessarily your area, John, but I'd love to hear what you make of it, which is the difficulty a lot of people have with God in a kind of philosophical sense, the idea that God would allow such horrors to take place on the earth. Now, can you just take us through why you think that is possible and what's going on?
Yeah, look. I have no problem with that. Actually, the issue for me is very clear. Once we understand the biblical creation account of the initial creation of Adam and Eve, and their sin, their rebellion against God, that they had free will in the garden, and they chose to rebel against God, it really wouldn't have mattered what it was, but God told them not to eat of a certain tree, which was called the tree of the fruit of good and evil, tree of knowledge, really. But they did. And so that from that moment on, the creation is flawed. It's damaged. It's broken. And so we see then that has a ripple effect right through the whole universe. The Bible talks about the curse, like, was spread through the universe. So what we're just saying then is that this sort of concept of, like, this utopian concept where God is defined as sort of a God that prevents everything evil, anything and everything happening that people consider evil to happen to anybody. That's a flawed concept, because from that moment of our great ancestor's decision, death entered the world, and death was a consequence of that decision, and we all die. So whether now I know there's people talk about suffering and various things like this, but all these things are manifestations of the evil heart of man. And man can be pretty evil. Now, I know that people then say, well, what about the babies who die and things like that? Well, God is a loving God, and we don't know exactly what happens to them, but that's sort of an unanswerable question from the biblical point of view. But we certainly can answer it from the point of view of those who are old enough to reason and understand, that we have to answer to a just God, a loving God, and the redemption out of this sort of paradox that we are sentenced to death, and hence ultimately to that lake of fire, is that God chose to redeem all those who trust in Him, and so He sent His Son Jesus Christ to die on that cross and take that original sin for us. The King James Bible uses a great old word called propitiation. Nowadays, they often use this word when you get a traffic fine, called expiation, to essentially Jesus expiated. He paid for our sin. This is the sin of Adam I'm talking about, that sentenced us to death. And by accepting that free gift, we are redeemed. So God is a loving God who has a loving plan. Now, I know there's a lot of evil in the world, and there's a lot of evil people, and there's also satanic forces and Luciferian forces, and we see a lot of that nowadays. But God didn't create evil. He did create the agents of evil, but those agents of evil are the ones who, through their free will, chose it. They chose that course of action. So we can't blame God for that. So what I'm saying, all of this flows from man's choice, and we are responsible for our own choices. So God has done His part, He offers us this free gift of eternal life. And when I say free, I mean free. There are no conditions. There are no requirements. It's absolutely it's amazing when you realize it, that there is this plan of redemption. And
it's not like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, John, is it, where they say, yes, you can have a roof over your head and you can have water, you can have food, you can have work, but only under certain circumstances. So you've got to jump through these hoops in order to get these things. It's not like that at all. But look, isn't there an inevitability to all of this, really? So if you're going to allow man freedom and you're going to allow man to explore knowledge for himself, you're going to then get people who abuse that and do it in an immoral fashion.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's a certain inevitability to the fact that you're going to get people who go astray, you know, and also lead others astray because they don't like the idea that that other people believe things different to them. There's a certain sort of envy and jealousy of those who adhere to God's standards. So there's a kind of inevitability to all of this, isn't there, that's unfolded over the centuries?
Absolutely, there is. I mean, we end up then into this kind of weird kind of almost paradoxical stuff. The Bible often uses words like mysteries, but there's a certain amount of it. Like, God sees the beginning from the end, so God can see everything, and there's prophecies in the Bible and things that are written there that we believe are still yet to happen, to come true. And yet at the same time, we have this personal responsibility about our decisions. And I think even this other idea too, that the evil flourishes, this is well known by the Lord, because it's written many, many times in the scriptures. But he also says that those evil ones will come to an end. So God knows this. That is a foregone conclusion. And why is it that we live in a world where so much goes wrong? I mean, there's no person who has a life that just sails through their life where there's no problems and troubles. It just doesn't happen. And I believe this is part of the developing of us as our soul, our character. This is part of the way we are to develop our life, because there is an afterlife. This is just a small sojourning here. And there's far, far more beyond this. And so in a lot of ways, this is what we're, you know, trying to get our heads around some of this stuff. And I admit I don't understand it at all. But I do understand that this is for our good. And I think it may not always seem.
Yeah, it might not seem like that. But look, I mean, it's also, you know, from what you're saying there, you know, it strikes me that you've got this relationship of God the Father with his children. And you've also got the family relationship, which is extremely important, which is obviously being broken down in all sorts of ways. But the family where the father has his sons and his daughters, and he looks at his son, and his son wants to do something. It's wrong. His father is torn, isn't he? Does he force that son to do the right thing, or does he allow his son to make mistakes? And it seems to me that that's what God is doing with his children.
Yes, I agree. That's right. And it's like trying to guide them, but in the end, they have to make their own decisions, and that's it's somewhat of a quandary, right?
You don't want God doesn't want to be the sort of coercive God that bullies everybody into doing the right thing. Also, look, there's another
automatons. Like, he doesn't want us to be automatons. No, not at all.
No. Listen, I think we should wind up now, but I think the last thing I'd like to throw at you, if you don't mind, John, is this whole business of alien life, because a lot of people just laugh. They say, well, with all those planets out there, there's bound to be life somewhere.
Well, again, I think that's based, again, on this false notion that evolution is true, that life evolved on Earth. Therefore, if you have billions of galaxies, then surely life must have evolved many, many other times on those galaxies. But it's predicated on that starting assumption, which is a false starting assumption. And so there's no reason to believe, because you have zillions of galaxies and planets, therefore, that life just randomly evolved out there. You see, I mean, this is, you have to sort of re-examine your axioms. So I would say, I turn this around and I say, we have a very big God who created a very big universe. And from the scriptures, it's clear to me that that universe is going to be there for a very long time. In fact, I have developed a model that sort of requires God to do it, but where he reverses entropy at some point in the future, and the universe is becomes self-sustaining, something like the burning bush. You know, the entropy must have been continually being reversed, and I believe that this universe will remain, and it has a purpose. Therefore, so I see that. That we as eternal souls, who knows, maybe we will travel to other planets and stars in this universe. But to assume that it's so big and therefore it has to have alien life, and of course that's sort of the story behind all these sort of science fiction stories, you know, like Star Trek and all these sort of things, but they're all based on evolutionary assumptions, which is flawed. And if I could bring this back to actually a different style of a biblical argument, the Bible tells us, now the history of the Bible is that God made Adam and Eve, and then from them all humans originated. It had to go through the flood, and there are only 8 survivors. But nevertheless, all humans are the sons and daughters of Adam, you know, eventually. The problem is that God, when God sends his son is born of a woman, of Mary, and therefore he is a human, but he is also fully God, right? And the scriptures, like particularly the story of Ruth and Boaz and a few others, talks about this idea of the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeems his kin. Well, Jesus Christ is the kinsman redeemer, and he died there on that cross to redeem the sons and daughters of Adam. So you see now the problem is this, that is the biblical message. Well, it doesn't relate to any other life forms in the universe. So Mr. and Mrs. Klingon or something or other out there on the Klingon homeworld, God's message is not related to them. It makes no sense. It's completely inconsistent.
Well, no, but because you've got to argue this point for the non-believers. What do you say to them? I mean, you know, you can't just go to a non-believer as a scientist and empirically say, oh well, it says this in the Bible, because they won't take any notice of you. You need to have hard evidence out there as to why there might not be alien species out on these planets. So I put it to you that, you know, you've got whatever the evolutionists say, I suppose it's something like 100 million years it's taken for life to evolve on Earth, and that, of course, in the history of the universe is an absolutely tiny little microsecond speck of all of the time. And what you're assuming is that that humanity here on Earth is the first ever of all those different lives that might evolve, because if we weren't the first, then there'd be other life out there which was observable in the universe. So, I mean, that's an argument that doesn't rely on you know, you having a biblical worldview. And of course, if you're going to actually make an impact as a scientist, but you've got to come up with empirical evidence like that, which would suggest that these little teeming millions of stars and planets don't have any life, because there's just no evidence of it having evolved over the previous, you know, thousands of millions of years.
Okay, so let's just have a look at that. Based on a belief in evolution, which they say life evolved over 3.8 billion years on Earth. Now, that's the argument they make. and they claim the universe is 13.8 billion years old. Therefore, they say that there'll be other planets, other star systems like that are well over 10 billion years old. This sort of those that formed early in the universe and this sort of thing. Okay, so if that's true, if that were true, that means some alien races may have 5 billion years on us, for example, that they may have been around for 5 billion years or more, or a billion years. So these are large numbers. And therefore, they would have developed technologies to travel or communicate through the universe. And who knows if they're arguing that this – in fact, the argument is that life is common in the universe. Life will just spontaneously form, and it's common. So that's the line of their argument. Therefore, if you then get like a telescope system like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and you point it at the stars and you start doing this on a massive scale now with modern telescope technology, they're now imaging thousands and thousands of stars. Look, I'm not sure exact time scale now, but they can do it on almost a weekly scale. And I think they're now running, SETI has been now running for over 50 years, and they have not detected anything whatsoever. Now, look, I've just said earlier that you can't, science is about null hypothesis. So, and of course, the universe is overdetermined. So even if you haven't detected anything, that doesn't prove that nothing, there isn't one out there somewhere, because it just simply means you haven't found it. But so far, the evidence is not looking good. That's the argument we could make, that there is no known detection of life on any other planet, and it doesn't look good for them. So now they're moving, and this is acknowledged by the SETI program. So now they are moving to look to other parts of the spectrum. So they've been using the radio frequency part of the spectrum, using radio telescopes, and now they want to move into the optical band, because they're saying, well, maybe aliens transmit signals in different ways. And that was also the reason why someone proposed that there was life made of dark matter, because they're saying we're not detecting them through our SETI research program. So they're saying maybe they're totally different to us, and that they are not made of what we call baryonic matter, like neutrons and protons and that type of thing. They're made of this other stuff, which we don't know what is. So you're now adding the depths of storytelling to even more fantastic ideas. But the onus is on the evolutionist to come up with the evidence, and none exists. Absolutely none exists. So they're continue to fund it because of their belief system. You see, it's not the hard science, it's what they believe to be true. So they are also subject to a belief system and a worldview. But they have not found anything.
They have their own religion, John.
Absolutely, they do. And I would add a caveat too, because say, for example, a man goes to Mars and kicks a rock and turns it over and finds some bacteria living on Mars. Now, that doesn't mean life even started on Mars. I mean, there's a possibility that you can have rocks that are kicked out from Earth and travel to Mars. That's another possibility. But what they're talking about is intelligent, sentient life. And that makes no sense. Maybe accidentally some microbe could be flung out from Earth in a volcanic eruption or something, and you could have it seeding other parts of our solar system.
Yeah, what about on a Mars lander as well? That all these various things that have arrived on Mars from Earth but sent out there by physicists.
Absolutely, you can. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, there's too many jokes along this line, but life, you know, even if they colonize Mars, some people have argued that there still wouldn't be any intelligent life on Mars because of those who have gone there. But you see, this is the problem, you know, it's part of that religious system. It's cultic in a lot of ways. And then there are people who I've read these books, Gerard de Hooft, Nobel laureate in theoretical physics. He imagines civilizations. They talk about different type civilizations, like whether they call class one, class two, and so on. And I think his class four generation or four civilization is where they have harnessed the power of their star. That means they have built a massive superstructure around the star and harness all of the energy from the star. So he talks about this type of thing. This is, you know, this is in a non-physics book, but it's just fiction. And so these people have nothing else to cling on to, that you know, because they don't believe in a creator or even a designer of the universe. So they have to then imagine. It's almost like Fred Hoyle's panspermia. They just have to imagine that there are these advanced, intelligent aliens that are so advanced they have power over their own stars and maybe even technologies such that we can't detect them. You know, like the Klingons cloaking their spacecraft to make them invisible and this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like they're thrashing around and they've actually failed, really completely failed to come up with any evidence to support what they're saying. Look, it's been a great pleasure having this discussion with you, John, and I'd just like to let our audience know where people can follow some of your work online. I don't know if you've published books, but I know you've got a very active and pretty comprehensive bulletin board forum type thing up online.
Yeah, it's at BibleScienceForum.com. You'll find pretty well everything there, BibleScienceForum.com. And I'm on Telegram, and I've got the links there anyway to my Telegram page. But thank you very much.
Okay, John, anytime. Thanks for joining us. Cheers.
Yep. Bye now, Tony.
Bye. Bye.